Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli, the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, straight from the Lost Island Heaven Purgatory, Rick Hess.
Mike, that was elegant, babe.
So, I have watched a few episodes of Lost, I think from, like, I don't know, season one, but I've not followed it. So I was just trying to get Rick to explain to me how it ended, and you did. It went on for several minutes, and I still really have no idea.
Well,
maybe they were all dead, or maybe they're not. Not sure.
It's not entirely clear. I got to read Doc Jensen on Entertainment Weekly, who does these 12 and 14 page elaborate explanations of what it all means, and then I go, that's not at all what I watched, but this sounds much better, so I'll go with this.
All right. Well, so we are still here on the island, that is the Education Gadfly Show.
Pat Wolf was very pleased with it. He thought it was redolent of Catholic imagery and Catholic theology, and Pat's a smart guy, so if Pat likes it, it must have been not too bad.
Nice. Well, speaking of someone who's been in purgatory but now is going on to a better place, Andy Smerick. Our sometimes co-host.
Look at that segue.
I know, sometimes, you know, I don't know if working, you know, as a visiting fellow for Fordham is considered purgatory, but it was kind of a way station.
Do you think his radio appearances are going to come back to haunt him?
Well, that's a good question.
Are they going to roll that stuff out on
him? That's a good question.
Where is Andy going?
So Andy is going to be the deputy commissioner in New Jersey.
Now, is this one of those situations like you have been offered in the past where they have four or five deputy commissioners?
No. I believe this is the only one.
The only one?
I believe.
It's him and Schundler.
It's going to
be
Schundler.
Schundler and Smerick show.
That's exactly right.
And I understand Andy is going to be the point guy for both schools along the Garden State Parkway. And maybe South Trenton. Maybe South, I don't know.
That's pretty funny. So what's the deal here, though, Rick? You know, Andy, it only took him, like, I don't know, over a year to find a really cool job like this after his administration gig. And here we still are doing the same thing year after year.
This is like Lost. This is like the beginning of season six.
Exactly.
The two guys are sitting there trapped on the island.
Trapped on the island. All right, well, let's do it again, Rick. Let's do it again. It's like Groundhog's Day, too.
It is.
All right.
And actually, you're giving me too much credit. I still haven't even ever served in an administration, so I can't even claim that.
Well, that is true. Not that you haven't been offered senior-level positions.
I would be very bad at them.
Okay,
let's
get started. We're kind of mixing things up. Stafford is going to host Pardon
Hello.
The Gadfly.
Whoa.
And then I believe is she you're coming back for Rate That Reform? No.
I asked Janie to do Rate That Reform earlier today. So when we did the little switch up, I thought I wouldn't deprive her of the pleasure.
Okay. All right. So we have a lot of versatile players on this team, Rick. So here we go. Let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
Question one. Race to the Top applications are due June 1st, but the Common Core national standards are coming out on June 2nd. Is this timeline a problem?
Well, so to explain, the reason it's connected is because in the Race to the Top proposals, states are supposed to promise that they are going to adopt these Common Core standards, at least if they want full points. So you have a state like Massachusetts, which is in a very tough situation because it's possible, if not likely, that their own standards are going to be better than the Common Core standards, and yet they have to promise to adopt the Common Core standards if they don't want to be docked.
Now, Mike, when you say that Massachusetts standards are better than the Common Core standards,
I said likely.
Here's
the deal. All right, so we know that current Massachusetts standards are quite good. We, you know, our folks that we trust really think highly of them, especially in English language arts. The draft that came out in English language arts in March from Common Core was pretty good, but not, you know, it was like a B+. And so we'll see. The final version that comes out on June 2nd might be better, and it might be so much better that it is pretty much in the same league as the Massachusetts standards. Let's hope.
Now, our buddy David Coleman, who's been instrumental in the NGACCSO effort, would say, hey, wait a minute. Actually, these standards are more elegant, more carefully scaffolded than even the Massachusetts standards.
Well, let's see them. I mean, we...
But you don't buy it.
We don't agree based on what we saw in March. No. But we're hopeful that these might be improved. And what comes out on June 2nd, but poor Massachusetts. I mean, it shows that the administration is making a huge mistake when they are putting so much pressure on the states to sign on to Common Core standards that aren't even out. They're asking the states to buy a pig and a poke. And by August 2nd, all of these Race to the Top states are supposed to sign on to the Common Core, adopt them formally, ditch their own standards. Makes me nervous, and it's also tricky politically. You know, Republicans have, for the most part, kind of held their noses. They're okay with this Common Core thing as long as it's truly state-led. But, you know, this Race to the Top bit certainly doesn't make them happy about it.
Mm.
Okay, topic number two.
Question number two. Representative Judy Chu from California has released a new plan to make school improvement grant turnarounds more flexible. She thinks that the four definitions of turnarounds are too rigid, and the unions like her ideas. What do we think?
You know, I'm in two minds on this. On the merits, I mean, I think Chu actually makes some reasonable points, that we've certainly oversold the various turnaround models, that the evidence for these is pretty weak. Flip side of it, though, is that if you've read Chu's document, it's really weak. The evidence on behalf of her favorite interventions is just incredibly not compelling. And the real concern is she's going to wind up letting schools and districts and educators off the hook, because suddenly school turnaround, school improvement just becomes one of these community endeavors. Mm-hmm. And anybody can spend ed money on anything from mental health to community health care. And if kids don't fare better in school, you know, she sets up a situation where nobody's actually responsible.
Look, this is a choice between two bad ideas. You've got the turnaround idea from the administration that is both has no strong evidence base, and there's lots of reasons to believe it's not going to work in most cases. And then you have Chu's ideas, which again has a weak evidence base and is not going to work in most places. I mean, nobody knows really what to do with these schools that are persistently failing, that also tend to be super high poverty and have all of those challenges. Probably the best thing to do is to close them down. And what we do know how to do is to start up some pretty good schools in their place. Some of those schools which could be high poverty, some of which might be more socioeconomically mixed. But we're not talking about that. Now it's just either turning around or doing the Chu. You know, but here's the point, Rick. Beggars, they can't be choosers.
Oh.
Topic number three.
that was just ugly.
You didn't hear the.
It works a lot better in writing when you see that.
You know, actually, and just one point before we transition is this is going to be real interesting because if Republicans choose to sit this stuff out mm-hmm. on the Rioth fight,
yeah,
then what you've got here is a real pretty clear split within the Democratic coalition.
Yeah.
And it's going to be real interesting to see how many votes the administration can rally up.
Yeah, no, and already it looks like there's signs that you got a split where, you know, the Harkin is probably in the Senate going to side with the unions, and George Miller in the House seems to be more on board with the administration. So the interesting fights yet again are within the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
Topic number three, Stafford.
Okay. So first the administration takes over the college loan industry, and then I-3 bans for-profit organizations. Does the administration have it out for for-profits?
You know, I think there's real concerns here. If you remember when Bob Shireman announced he was leaving the department a couple weeks ago, for-profit higher education company stocks bounced 5 to 10% that day.
Keep in mind, Shireman was a senior official in charge of student loan stuff in the administration.
Exactly. So, I mean, that's a pretty clear signal that at least the folks in the business and the investors thought that Shireman, was gunning for them. The I-3 stuff. It's not that for-profits are entirely banned. It's that they're not allowed to be the primary bidders, and they can only participate through, you know, a complicated RFP process. You know, it sure looks like the administration is doing what it can to squeeze for-profits out of a whole bunch of, you know, the education space. And if you're a guy like me who thinks for-profits actually bring a bunch of value to the table, mm-hmm. this is a real concern.
Yeah, I mean, the point is we should be encouraging people to invest in the K-12 space, right? Because that's going to help us develop new products, new ideas, R&D. You know, probably my favorite organization right now has got to be Wireless Generation. I know you're a big fan too, Rick, and you've helped get attention for them in the policy world. Here is a for-profit company that's got to be doing better, more interesting, thoughtful R&D in the education space than just about anybody. Any of the labs or the R&D center or anything that we've tried to fund publicly. And yet there they are up there in New York City, in Brooklyn, at the foot of the Brooklyn Bridge, just doing all kinds of cool stuff.
You know, I mean, one of the things is I think folks are absolutely right to be wary of for-profits. Sure, for-profits, you know, have incentives to cut corners, do things wrong, right? Right now we're watching this massive Gulf oil spill. BP and, you know, Transoceanic haven't distinguished themselves. But for-profits also have an incentive to try to control costs in ways that nonprofits don't, to grow with a rapidity which we don't see in nonprofits. You know, so when it comes to these questions of trying to scale up improvements, for-profits can be an enormously useful piece of the puzzle. But what we don't see is them being treated like a piece of the puzzle. We see them being treated as a last recourse.
You know, this is a good segue for us to talk about our new model here in the Education Gadfly Show, our pay to play.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm just kidding. We are going to be free forever, Rick. You know why?
Why is that, baby?
Because we're not sure people would actually pay anything to listen to you and me. But they would probably pay something to listen to Amber Winkler in her Research Minute. You know, Rick, I should have said at the top of the show, we have to be very careful today because with Laura, our producer, on vacation, our editing capacity is very low here in the office. So pretty much we say it, they're going to hear it. This is unusual, folks. Usually, Laura does a nice job editing out our dumbest and, you know, just most long-winded discussions. So if it seems a little not quite so tight today, now you know why.
Mm.
But Amber, always gets right to the point. How are you today, Amber?
I'm going to get to the point. Doing great.
You know, and just as far as Amber goes, I got to say, last night I was out with a couple of folks at a local watering hole, including a state secretary of education and the rest.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all insisting that we need to spin Amber Winkler off from the podcast. So they don't want to have to listen to us for 10 minutes before they get their Amber.
It would kill it. It would kill us.
They want Amber kind of unplugged.
I know.
Including, I'll name names, Larry Berger.
Of Wireless Generation.
Wow. He came up to me and said, you know, if this is just my dream to listen to research studies in a southern accent like you have. And I thought, be still my heart.
Love it. Love it. All right. Well, give them what they want, Amber. What are we talking about this week?
Oh, I know. My head's getting swelled. This week, we have a new report out by Ball State University that updates a charter funding report that Fordham did in 05 using 02-03 data. So that report found charter schools got about 21% less per pupil than districts. So this new report presents 06-07 data for 25 states, including D.C. So now we've got about 7 more states than we did last time. And that means more than 90% of the nation's charter population is represented. This time, the discrepancy is about 19%, so not much of a change. The average state disparity was about 2,200 per pupil. Importantly, those differences do not justify, differences in student need don't justify it. So they calculated, you know, special ed and all those students' populations into the calculation. The chief culprit was the charter school's lack of access to local and capital funding. No big surprise there. Statewide, more than 85% of the disparity between charter and district school funding resulted in differences in access to local revenues. Finally, they examined districts with large concentrations of charters. These are obviously mostly urban areas. Largest disparities were in New Orleans, Newark, so our friend Andy's got some work to do, and New Haven. Albuquerque and Houston, on the other hand, approached parity.
Bam.
Bam. Bam. A minute? Did I do it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
More or less. Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, interesting. I mean, we had done this work before, and they actually improved upon our work. I won't get real deep into the methods, but the way that they calculated per pupil was much better than what we had done.
Mm-hmm. But still, so, I mean, the big news here is sort of the non-news, is that there's been very little change. Over, what, a four-year period?
That's right. Well, 03, right, 02, 03, 06, 07.
So 4 years later, this problem is still with us. Now, a couple questions. First of all, Rick, when this comes out, should charter advocates say primarily, hey, this is unfair, we need more money? Or should they say, hey, look at how cost-effective we are, and yay for charter schools for being so cost-effective?
Mm.
Good question.
You know, I think what they should do is they should lead with the cost-effectiveness argument as a way to make their case for more resources.
Hmm. Interesting.
What's your take?
No, I don't know. I think the cost-effective point is interesting. I mean, so we do have these, I mean, big, big differences in spending, yet I think a fair look at the research evidence would say that on the whole, charters and traditional public schools are performing at about the same level. Maybe give an edge to charters if you look at charters that are up for more than 1 year and look at, you know, how they do over time. You know, I mean, but basically, you know, I think if you got fair people, you'd say, look, pretty much they're in the same ballpark, right? And yet, you know, we're only spending, you know, what, 80 cents on the dollar for charter schools. I mean, that's a huge savings, right? Now, is this just more evidence that, well, we've known this forever, spending doesn't really seem to matter that much? I mean, that's important of itself. And yet, I don't know that, I think charter people will be nervous about that because, look, charter schools want more money.
Yeah,
right?
That's right.
They do.
That's not the spin, right, from the Alliance today.
Yeah, and you can understand why. So let me ask you this, Amber. Now, people might say, look, okay, so a lot of this is local funding, but it's exactly the local funding that is currently going away in this recession because the property taxes are plummeting.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, are we going to see in a couple of years more parity? Because at the district level, they're just losing a lot of the funding they've got now.
I have no answer to that question, Mike. But I mean, a reasonable person, that could be a hypothesis. Mm-hmm. What do you think? I mean, I don't know if there's any definitive way to say that's the way this is going to go.
Mm-hmm. Actually, one question relative to that is, does this data include philanthropic support, or is this just state allocations, I presume?
I think this is just state allocations, but I'm not 100%
sure. You know, one of the interesting things is when we talk about the 500, you know, just phenomenal charters out there, you know, I think none of them that I know of actually run for the actual state allocation.
Right.
And so one of the questions here, too, is charters on the whole are operating, you know, just for 80% cents on the dollar, but the charters that get us all excited actually don't seem to be running any cheaper than the adjacent district schools.
All right. The KIPPs of the world. Yeah. Interesting.
That's a very good point. All right, Amber, what is the song?
So since we're talking about cash flow differences, we have Money by Pink Floyd.
It's a good song.
Yeah. Can you hear that?
Yeah.
Oh, I love
it. Doesn't Billy Joel have a song about money? Easy Money from the Rodney Dangerfield movie. Easy Money.
So I don't know, Rick, I think that was a repeat of a song that we've used before.
We can plug in Easy Money.
Look, you know, if Amber's going to get her own show, I mean, there's a lot of questions. One is, does she get more than a minute?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if she gets more than a minute, is for one study, or does she have to do like several studies?
No, I think it would be like half an hour, be Amber Unplugged. She would talk research, she would talk style, she would talk office gossip.
You know, I might actually listen to that. All right. Well, it's now time for us to rate that reform.
All right.
Janie, almost making the mistake of talking over the music.
She's not used to it. It's a new position for me.
Research assistant Janie, what reform are we rating this week?
I don't know if there's a good title for it. How about I just jump into it? Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. So some New Jersey high school students got a bit of a free joyride last week. They boarded their bus around 7:45 a.m., expecting to be taken to school, just like any other day. But when their bus meandered onto some strange streets and finally took an exit and merged onto the Jersey Turnpike, they knew there was something wrong. Turns out the bus driver had picked up the wrong group of kids. The driver was supposed to pick up 7th and 8th graders at 9 a.m. to take them to a Six Flags amusement park for a field trip. Unfortunately for those middle schoolers, the driver was unusually punctual, arriving over an hour early and unknowingly greeting a completely different group of students. Once the bus veered onto the Jersey Turnpike, the students on the bus became concerned and called their parents at school to report that the bus driver was barreling towards the amusement park and refused to turn back. But to the students' relief, the bus driver eventually heeded the advice of concerned administrators and parents on the phone and turned the bus around. So, Mr. or Mrs. Bus Driver, you get an A for effort, so congrats for that. But your execution is pretty abysmal. You know, good for you for being on time, even an hour early. But next time, make sure you're carrying the right kids first. You know, usually a field trip would require some sort of chaperone. So if there's no one on the bus that's older than 16, that might be a sign that something's wrong. And, you know, usually students who are going on a field trip are brimming with excitement at the beginning of the excursion and not terrified that you're trying to abduct them. So these are some things you might want to look out for next time. The kids themselves are another issue entirely, because if someone tried to take me on a free field trip, I would be all for it, not, you know, terrified. But bus driver, I give you a C.
Wow. So let me get this straight again. How old were the kids he actually was taking on the turnpike?
High schoolers.
They were high schoolers. Okay.
No. The ones he was trying to take on the trip were middle schoolers. The ones that he ended up actually picking up were high schoolers.
I see. Yeah, I'm impressed those high schoolers weren't like, dude, awesome.
I know.
Well, I'm not impressed. I'm a little concerned. What kind of whiny kids are we raising?
Exactly. Dude, I was going to rate that part of the reform, but I thought, you know.
I was standing here waiting for my school bus to pick me up and take me to school.
Right.
My school bus shows up.
Uh-huh.
Is mistakenly take me to an amusement park, and my response is to cryingly get my parents on the phone to make them have the driver stop.
Exactly.
What happened to initiative?
No,
I
think this is like, you know, one of these, you know, after school movies that's like with a happy ending, like, woo, it's every kid's fantasy. Go to
you would
Six
think.
Flags.
And instead, the kids are sitting there bawling their, you know, the other problem though is, I gotta say, rate that reform has now become, to my mind, indistinguishable from News of the Weird.
Oh, yes. That is always a risk that we veer back into that territory.
It's hard to think of poor time management by bus drivers as really constituting a meaningful reform attempt.
Hey, I'm just taking my cues from Stafford.
Yeah, well, like, you know, yeah, the reform crowd right now, it was just a slow news week.
Yeah, it was a little dry.
I just want to know, with John Schnur, with Joe Williams, would they be like, this is part of the reform agenda?
Well, you know what? I this would probably not happen at a charter school. You know why? A lot of them don't provide busing. So,
there you go.
Hey, Rick, let me ask you this. How often do you go to amusement parks in a given year?
Not as often as I'd like. Usually once or twice.
That's it, though. Once or twice. Yeah, Rick usually has a tradition of taking off a day and going.
At least a day.
Yeah.
I know. It's been a tough.
Well, now we know why this one hits close to home. All right. Well, that is all the time we have. We appreciate everybody listening. And again, apologize for the fact that we couldn't edit out some of our less. No, I'm just kidding. That's, yeah. See, this part we need to edit out.
And by that, you mean you're not kidding.
By this, I mean I'm not kidding. Okay, Rick, until next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.